My name is Bojan Krosnov. I'm with a company called Storpool, which is, so I'm kind of the chief of product, one of the founders of the company. I am a cloud architect in terms of I've helped a number of kind of hosting companies and cloud operators build clouds from scratch. I take care of what we call external technology in Storpool, which is everything from support, pre-sales, designing solutions for customers, things like that. And my background from before Storpool was in service providers like ISPs and packet processing, what's now called SDN, and things like that. What we do is a fast and efficient software-defined block storage system. Right? So it's kind of a mouthful. It's a lot of description there. It's used mostly by MSPs, cloud service providers, and hosting companies, and private clouds. So we have some customers who have tried public cloud, and they weren't happy with how that was working out for them, and they did private cloud afterwards, and the private cloud is based on Storpool storage technology underneath. It was started in 2011, and it's a clean slate from scratch design, meaning we didn't use ZFS or Ceph or like another underlying technology. We designed it, we built it. So back in kind of end of 2011, we after meeting a few prospects, customers, we sat in front of a whiteboard and kind of chalked how that solution should look like and what's ideal and what's the best way to do it. And we came up with a design, which we later found out is very similar to, in terms of high-level architecture, is very similar to the way Ceph works. So if you guys are familiar with Ceph, our stuff works in a very similar way, kind of in terms of high-level architecture. When you dig deeper into kind of the low-level architecture and the implementation and all that, it's very different from Ceph, but at the higher level, it is similar. Similar concepts. It's a scale-out system. It's API-controlled, meaning you could kind of create and delete volumes and create snapshots many times a second, right? It has end-to-end data integrity like ZFS, meaning the data you store in the system is guaranteed to be the data you get back. And it uses a copy-on-write on disk format, which gives us things like thin provisioning, space-efficient clones, all these nice features. Most, why is Storpool at this conference? Because most of our deployments are with the KVM hypervisor. So if you look at most storage vendors out there, they would focus on the kind of more enterprise side of more enterprise type ecosystems like VMware and Oracle and Microsoft, the enterprise ecosystems. And most of our deployments, maybe because of our background and where we come from, are with Linux and the KVM hypervisor. We do have some with Xen and KVM and VMware, etc. And we do have some deployments which use, which run bare metal workloads, meaning storage system connects to physical servers rather than virtual machines. We have deep integrations with OpenStack, OpenNebula, ONAP, Kubernetes recently, and CloudStack also recently. These integrations, all of them kind of expose functionality of the storage system through the cloud management layer, right? So what does that mean? That it means that in, say, OpenStack, if you go and create an image or kind of a virtual disk, that virtual disk gets its own volume, its own LUN in the storage system underneath. It's not kind of, our solution is not the only one that does that, does it like that in OpenStack or CloudStack. So it means that our integrations with these kinds of systems, these integrations are plugins to the higher level management system, right? About 2 years ago, when we decided to do a CloudStack integration, these were our goals. Goal number one, we would like to expose a lot of the functionality we have in the storage system. We would like to expose that through CloudStack. And we'd like to kind of map concepts that we have in the underlying system to concepts in CloudStack. This is kind of necessary because there are no standards for how things are named or for how things behave. So, for example, snapshots in CloudStack are quite different from snapshots in OpenStack, right? It's a very different idea and concept behind it. We decided to do it for the KVM hypervisor only and for the KVM hypervisor first. And we wanted to be our integration with CloudStack to behave similarly to primary storage backends that already exist. So we didn't want kind of the customer, when they go to CloudStack, they shouldn't be surprised by how the store pool backend works. Like it should work in a similar way, should behave in a similar way to what they used to. So this is back in 2016. A prospect, not yet a customer, told us they like store pool and they want to use it with CloudStack. And you know, we brought up an environment. It took us about 2 weeks to get all the kind of functions of the integration working. This is a testament to, it is fairly easy to add a plugin. So in CloudStack, when there is already a primary storage, kind of a number of primary storage plugins, so at that time there were like 4 or 5 primary storage plugins, what we did is we implemented another one of these. And all these plugins are open source and kind of copy the code and substitute calls to these other systems with calls to store pools generally, right? So there are some kind of weird corner cases, but generally that's how it worked. At the end, our customer then decided to use a different cloud management system. They went for something called ONA. So from 2016 to 2018, this project of, you know, the store pool and to CloudStack integration just sat on the shelf. Meaning no one was using it, and we just had the code, right? And then in 2018, we restarted our kind of effort to address CloudStack customers. We got our first production deployments with CloudStack this year. And our current kind of roadmap for the integration is based on feedback we are getting from our first deployments. This is where it lives, kind of in GitHub. So it's out of tree, and it's probably going to remain out of tree, meaning it's not kind of in the CloudStack repository. It's in a separate repository. And for the time being, it makes sense for it to be in a separate repository. The way it works is it is, it builds in separately from CloudStack, so you could have like a already deployed CloudStack installation. You build this, you drop 2 jar files, you restart the CloudStack controller, and then suddenly you have another item in the drop-down list, right? So you can select store pool apart from Gluster and Ceph and, you know, the integrated storage plugins. Right, so it implements what's called a primary storage data store driver. And if you're for KVM only, so if you're using other hypervisors, so if you're using, for example, CloudStack with VMware, this integration doesn't help you in terms of it's not kind of, it's not designed for CloudStack with VMware. If you're using CloudStack with VMware, the way you would connect the store pool storage system to that is underneath the VMware hypervisor. So it doesn't, in that case, it doesn't talk directly to CloudStack. A little bit of background of how this works. So you can think of it as having a control plane and a data plane. The data plane looks like this. This is the store pool services that are used to process storage operations. So you can imagine on one of these hosts, you have a virtual machine on top, somewhere up there. You give that virtual machine raw disk images, which correspond to block devices in the host. restore pool block device driver in the host operating system in KVM. And that block device driver knows where data is in the cluster, and it talks to a number of Torpo storage servers. Servers take care of data stored on drives within the servers. Servers that are not necessarily deployed on the same physical hosts. So you could have like a separate storage system and that's Torpo storage servers and a set of hypervisors, and these are just used to access the storage system. And in that case, they would be separated. So you would have hosts, like physical servers on which only the driver is installed and physical servers on which only the server is installed, so you can split the services. So servers talk to each other, they form a cluster, and the block device driver knows where data is in the cluster ahead of time, meaning when there is a storage operation to process, it kind of contacts the server that has the data. There is no kind of caching of metadata or anything like that. Well, it's like caching, but it's kind of 100% caching for metadata, right? Control plane with REST API and HTTP JSON. So the store pool to cloud stack integration is essentially on this plane, meaning cloud stack, when cloud stack needs to create a volume, it does a store pool API call. When cloud stack needs to attach a storage volume to a host, it does an API call to store pool, right? And there is kind of data plane, which is completely independent of that, which needs to be set up, right? So you need a working store pool block device driver in the host, and in order to process reads and writes, et cetera. And the data plane has all the kind of performance critical aspects of the storage solution. So things like using RDMA in network interface cards, doing kernel bypass so we don't need to kind of context switch all the time to process each storage operation, and things like that. So this is kind of the data plane part, gives you block devices in dev store pool. You can create, delete, et cetera. And So we mapped like higher level functionality. You go in the cloud stack UI and you say, create me a root volume from an ISO. And that corresponds to a call called create volume async in the store pool plugin. So we kind of mapped everything you want to be able to do through the cloud stack UI. We mapped that into a low level functionality in the we map that to function calls in the store pool plugin, which maps to API calls in the store pool, right? So for example, to live migrate a virtual machine from one host to the other, what happens on the storage backend is that the virtual disks of this virtual machine are attached to the new hypervisor, virtual machine kind of migrated. And then after it's migrated, the virtual disks on the old hypervisor are detached. So you don't get kind of hanging block devices that map to volumes you don't need. So this is kind of, this table is also on it's on GitHub on the kind of documentation page. One of the hiccups we had when we were integrating store pool with cloud stack was this in the iSCSI driver. What happens is if you have multiple storage backends, say iSCSI and store pool and maybe some others, when you detach a volume, the iSCSI driver, instead of failing and returning the correct error that it's not a block device which is managed by the iSCSI driver, what it does, it says, yes, I detached it. So there is this small patch for cloud stack proper, which changes this return to a return false, which unfortunately still hasn't been applied. So it was kind of, we tried to get it through the process, but maybe we haven't put enough kind of effort in communicating why we need this and why it won't break anything, and running the tests and keeping it mergeable, keeping it up to date. That's that. I think this was the only serious obstacle to us to Storpo implementing a primary storage plugin for CloudStack. Everything else was just fine. And in terms of roadmap, something that started in the Storpo CloudStack plugin is support for deployments with multiple storage clusters. So initially we started with this idea that you have one CloudStack controller and that manages a set of hypervisors, and this set of hypervisors talks to one Storpo storage system underneath. And with our deployments this year, we found that a very typical case in CloudStack is you have one controller and controller that manages several sets of hypervisors, several clusters, that each have access to one storage system or multiple storage systems. So we need to kind of add support for that in the driver. And our kind of ideas, which are, haven't been committed to the roadmap yet, is expose Storpo's QoS functionality through CloudStack. So that would make it similar to the way the SolidFire driver for CloudStack works. So you would be able to select kind of a QoS level or QoS profile for a volume. Expose the Storpo snapshots and multi-site capabilities through the new CloudStack backup service. So in Storpo, you could have multiple clusters in different locations. You could create snapshots in one cluster and send these snapshots to another cluster. And a number of our customers use this for backup in DR, not with CloudStack, but with kind of external orchestration. So they wrote the scripts to kind of create the backups and move them to the other side. And the CloudStack backup service is actually a very good place to... Its concept maps very well with this underlying functionality in Storpo. This would need, obviously, some development in us kind of writing the plugin for the backup service in CloudStack. And the other thing we've put on the roadmap and we think it's nice to have but not committed yet is implement migration between different... from Storpo to Storpo as well as between Storpo and non-Storpo storage, primary storage. Do you guys have any questions so far? How many of you use CloudStack? Okay, cool. And is there any functionality that you expect from a primary storage system that I didn't mention, or it wasn't clear enough in the presentation? It's all clear, no?
So I did have one quick question. If it's not, you already kind of touched on it about the QoS. So what is it that held you back from implementing on the first blush? Is it just the amount of time it would take, or was there some complication?
I think the first time we did this, we were also trying to keep the scope minimal. If I remember correctly, the QoS functionality actually needed changes in the UI, not just drop a jar file in a directory and everything works. It also needed changes in the UI, like adding the necessary fields and things like that. If I remember correctly, this was like 2 years ago. Yeah. Cool. So since this was kind of short. Maybe when we submitted the talk, we didn't consider how much can we talk about like a primary storage plugin. Like there's not much more to tell you guys about it. I have this kind of additional, an interesting topic which I think is good for this audience, right? So first, like this. In many systems, you have a characteristic of the system which goes like this. So you have operations per second versus latency. And when you increase the kind of operations per second, you get to a point where the system saturates, and from there on, you don't get more operations per second. You only get higher latency. The reason you get higher latency is queuing delay, meaning you know you have higher demand than you can satisfy, so your operations sit on a queue somewhere. This applies to databases, storage systems, application servers, message queues with workers, all kinds of situations, right? And just to prove that it's not just a made-up concept, and it actually you can see that in real systems. This is a store pool storage system with NVMe drives underneath, and you can see kind of a similar shape. So it's kind of a slope from zero operations per second up to where somewhere around here where it saturates, and then it goes horizontal or dips slightly, maybe. And like an ideal system would look like this, so it would have a sharp knee there, but these systems are quite complex and they have many different bottlenecks in kind of in the network interface card, in the drives underneath, in many different places. So what happens here is that because it's a more complex system, it's a smoother transition from what we call the elastic area of the curve to the saturated area of the curve. Elastic means you provide more operation, like you request more operations per second, you get more operations per second, right? Maybe it's slightly slower, right? So this transition is not as sharp as the ideal world, right? So in terms of, for all these cases, the best service you can deliver as a kind of an application developer or someone that runs a, say, mobile application, web application, any kind of application, the best service you can deliver to your customers is if you sit at this end of the curve, meaning you have systems which are, you know, which can process 10 times more or 100 times more operations per second than what you need, and you run them at 1% load, and then that's how you get the lowest latency for your service. It's very wasteful, right? But if you kind of look at the first principles underneath, this is how you provide the best service. Obviously, we don't want to be that wasteful. So what we do is we try to keep our systems somewhere before that need there and provide the lowest cost per delivered resource and provide a service which is with a slightly higher latency and a lot cheaper, because in this case you're running the system at say 60% load, 80% load, right? The kind of one issue you have with that kind of running a system at 80% load is that the moment that load spikes and goes above 100%, you go above this knee and you get only pain, right? Meaning kind of operations sit on queues and instead of the 1 millisecond latency that you're used to, you suddenly get 10 milliseconds of latency because it's just very different. And then in our area, like in block storage systems, most vendors would brag about numbers which are kind of far to the right over there on the curve. They would kind of saturate the system and tell you this system can do a million IOPS, but they would never tell you it would do a million IOPS at 10 millisecond latency, and it's useless at that kind of latency, right? So because of that observation, one thing we wanted to do is translate. We believe that a low latency storage system can translate into better service for customers, can translate into applications running faster. And we've been trying to kind of explain this using kind of this kind of chart and concepts to people, but it's hard to explain. So we decided to kind of do a test and show it. So DigitalOcean and AWS are kind of some of the largest public cloud operators. So we took virtual machines in DigitalOcean, AWS, and at a store pool customer. These are basically identical virtual machines except for the CPU frequency. So the DigitalOcean and AWS run at 3.4 gigahertz, And the VM at our customer runs at 3.1. And it's the same generation of CPU, so it's not very different. We run the same application stack on all of them, meaning Ubuntu with the Ubuntu or AWS applied kernel, with the same version of PostgreSQL and the same testing tools on top. And this is what we got. So this is in PGBench, which is a PostgreSQL benchmark. This is the number of parallel clients. It somewhat relates to I/O depth or queue depth, but not directly. So the kind of the I/O depth we see underneath is several times the number of parallel clients. So the kind of the blue line here in the middle is DigitalOcean local SSD. Underneath that, you have the Amazon EBS with 20,000 provisioned IOs. The orange line here, so that line, this costs like $1,400 dollars per month, getting that many IOs per second. And it's kind of somewhat ridiculous because these other services down there, they cost $100 per month. So it's like 14 times more than your regular SSD disk in a cloud service, right? And then the four lines up top are store pool with an IOPS limit and store pool without the IOPS limit. And what I'm doing here is I'm again showing you like a throughput, the throughput aspect of it. Like with store pool, if you have 16 parallel clients, you will be able to get 7,500 transactions per second on the PGBench, you know, benchmark. And I told you that's not kind of the important way to measure it. The good way to measure it would be with something like this. So this on the x-axis is latency, and on the y-axis is transactions per second. So same database, same virtual machine, same software stack, same everything. The only thing we're changing is the storage system underneath. The blue cyan line up there, that's a store pool on NVMEs without an IOPS limit, without a QoS limit applied. The orange line is store pool on NVMEs with a 20,000 IOPS per second limit. And then you have the others and the others. And the orange thing here is digital, the red thing down there is DigitalOcean block storage. So it's kind of a very flat line down there. What does this mean? That between Amazon EBS with 20,000 provisioned IOPS and store pool without a limit, you get 4.5 times more transactions per second for the same latency. You know, same virtual machine. In both places, you get a terabyte of SSD-based storage. And in one case, you're able to get 8,000, almost 8,000 transactions per second from the database. And in the other case, you're able to get like 1,800, right? So if as a user of these cloud services, if you just look at the data sheet and you know one of them says 20,000 IOPS per second and the other one also says 20,000 IOPS per second, this is far from the whole story. So your application will perform wildly differently on one service and the other service. And in the other direction, it's so between DigitalOcean local storage and store pool NVMe, there is like half the latency for the same amount of IOPS. And if you take, what's the green one, Amazon with 20,000 provision IOPS versus Toroplon and NVMEs, that's seven times lower latency for the same amount of transactions per second, right? So why does this matter? Say you're an application developer for a mobile application, web application. One of the the way you scale from running on a single server to kind of being able to sustain 50 million daily active users, right, is you split the application into separate pieces and these run on different servers. At some point, you get into having to shard your transactional database, so having to kind of move different tables or different users to different databases because you can't fit them in one. Well, this tells you that without increasing the latency of the application, you can postpone that sharding of the database significantly. Like, you can get 4 times more transactions per second at the same latency level without kind of making your application slower. Vertical scaling before horizontal scaling, right? Makes it a lot simpler, a lot easier for application developers. Yeah, so that was that. Cool. Any questions?
Is RDMA required?
No. So, in terms of support for network interface cards, we have a compatibility list. Everything that's on that compatibility list will work. Everything that's on that compatibility list we have in the lab and we check with each new version of Storpool. There is also like a sublist of that, which is the recommended models of network interface cards, which is two generations of Intel NICs and 3 generations of Mellanox NICs. And on all of them, we get these kinds of numbers. In different way, though. So Mellanox NICs is RDMA, and on Intel NICs is user mode driver. So like, the Intel way of doing things and the Mellanox way of doing things. We don't use Rocky, but we use RDMA. So on the wire, it's an Ethernet frame. It's not a Rocky thing. And so one of the differences between Mellanox and Intel is that on the Mellanox NICs, you can get a Q-pair as standard from the card. So like an application can request from the driver, give me a Q-pair, and then you can send and receive packets. On the Intel NICs, it's a bit harder, right? So it's not like a standard function of the driver, and you need to go through hoops to get that. Okay. Cool. Let me know if you have any questions. That was all.